Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Friday, the 23rd of February, these are our main stories. Alexei Navalny's mother has finally been allowed to see her son's body. She says she's now under pressure not to give him a public funeral.
They want the burial done in secret, with no farewells. They want to take me to the edge of the cemetery, show me a fresh grave and say, "Your son is here." I won't agree to that.
Firefighters in the Spanish city of Valencia are tackling a huge blaze at a 14-story block of flats. Plus,
we are particularly in love as physicists with positronium. It's a perfect system to do experiments with.
What is positronium? The so-called exotic atom that's got scientists' hearts all aflutter. Also in this podcast, President Biden condemns a court ruling in Alabama that says embryos and fertilized eggs count as children. And
the world's biggest trading partners have received the most pandas, according to academic studies. So it seems that when China wants to improve its economy, it tends to lend out more pandas.
Why China's returning to panda diplomacy? They want the funeral to be done in secret. They don't want any farewells. The words of Alexei Navalny's mother, who says she's under pressure from the Russian authorities not to give a proper send-off for her son. Lyudmila Navalnaya was speaking after being allowed to see his body for the first time, driven at night time to a municipal morgue near the penal colony where he'd been incarcerated. The investigators apparently told her they know the cause of Alexei Navalny's death, but for the rest of the world it remains a mystery, with many accusing the Russian authorities of trying to cover it up. Our East European correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
In this short video statement, Alexei Navalny's mother says she's being blackmailed by those responsible for investigating her son's death. She says they're insisting that he be buried in secret up in the Arctic, where the opposition politician died suddenly in prison last week. Lyudmila Navalnaya says one investigator even warned her that time was not on her side, that her son's body was decomposing. After 6 days, she has finally been allowed into the mortuary to see the body, but she says officials won't release her son for burial unless she agrees to their terms.
They want the burial done in secret, with no farewells. They want to take me to the edge of the cemetery, show me a fresh grave and say, "Your son is here." I won't agree to that. I want you, those he was dear to, those for whom his death was a personal tragedy, to have the chance to say goodbye.
There is clearly concern that a public funeral for Alexei Navalny could turn into a mass protest. The Kremlin won't want to risk that, especially just before a presidential election, when the image it wants to project is of a country united behind a leader and his war. Lyudmila Navalnaya says she has now signed an official certificate which records natural causes for her son's death. For now, there are no more details. But the delay in releasing his body has led those close to Navalny to accuse the authorities of killing him, more than 3 years after he was poisoned with a Novichok nerve agent and nearly died. Vladimir Putin still hasn't made any comment.
Sarah Rainsford. There have been some truly terrifying scenes from the Spanish city of Valencia, with an apartment block on fire and firefighters struggling to get it under control. Pictures showed residents trapped inside, at least one person leaping from a window. Our reporter Marion Strawn was there, and shortly before recording this edition of the Global News podcast, she described the scene.
In front of me is a 14-story building, completely blackened. In just about every window, you can see fire. The whole building is burnt. At the moment, there's like a ladder on top of a very huge ladder, which is moving up and down, spurting out water. But it's such an enormous fire, it will dent hardly any of the fire because there's about 140 dwellings in this building. And on the facade, I can see it looks about 50 windows and they have all got fire in all of them.
I realise it's very early to ask this, but has anyone speculated on how this may have started?
What we know is that the building was covered in polyurethane, which is the sort of foam insulation that was used in many buildings in the early 2000s when there was a building boom and had disastrous consequences in other places as well. This is the worst fire in Valencia ever. It seemed to have started on the fourth floor. We don't know how at the moment.
We've seen photos of people jumping out of windows. What do we know about the rescue effort?
The most dramatic rescue we know about is when two people, a woman and a man, were stuck on the seventh floor. And after several hours, the firemen had got there, but they couldn't get into the balcony. But eventually they managed to break through the balcony glass. So two people were rescued in that dramatic way. The fire is still going on and it looks devastating.
Marion Strawn. There's going to be a renewed effort to resolve the ongoing conflict in Gaza. The Israeli government is to send a delegation to Paris on Friday for talks with representatives of Egypt, Qatar and the United States. The move comes after the US Middle East envoy Brett McGurk held talks with Israeli cabinet members, including the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. With the latest from Jerusalem, here's our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams.
The United States is pushing hard for a ceasefire deal before the start of Ramadan in a little over 2 weeks. Joe Biden's Middle East envoy, Brett McGurk, is reported to have urged Benjamin Netanyahu to rejoin talks amid reports that Hamas may have softened its position. 10 days ago, Mr. Netanyahu called Hamas's conditions for a deal delusional. The fact that Israel is sending a high-level delegation to Paris does not in itself suggest a deal is imminent. Israel's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant says the delegation will have expanded authority to negotiate, another small sign of possible progress, but Israel and Hamas are still thought to be far apart on a number of issues, including how many Palestinian prisoners might be released in exchange for the remaining 134 Israeli hostages.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, a number of people were killed in Rafah and several homes and a mosque destroyed during one of the heaviest bombardments the overcrowded Gazan town has suffered. Speaking during the G20 meeting in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's Foreign Minister Mauro Vieira said many countries had raised concerns about the possibility of an imminent Israeli ground offensive there. Also at that meeting was Egypt's Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry. His government, along with the US and Qatar, have been trying to negotiate a longer-term peace plan. He spoke to Ione Wells about the current state of these diplomatic efforts.
From our perspective, it's important to end the military conflict and deal with the issue through diplomatic channels. Still, there is a view that there should be a temporary pause rather than a permanent cessation of hostilities. But I think there's a consensus that we have to deal with this situation and we have to provide greater humanitarian assistance and also deal with the threat associated with displacement of the Palestinian people.
What would you say to some of Israel's allies who are in the room for the G20 summit? What can they do to try and prevent the invasion of Rafah, which is something that Israel has said is imminent?
Well, I think all members have to advocate on basis of principle and the recognitions of the dangers that are associated with the conflict and its potential for escalation and the impact on the humanitarian dimension and the loss of life and damage to the infrastructure are issues that we have to give a priority dealing with.
From Egypt's perspective, what would be the impact of an invasion of Rafah, both for Palestinians but also the wider region?
Egypt's position has been clear that it does not see the possibility of wide-scale military activity in Rafah because of the accumulation of 1.2 million civilians in that area. The consequences would be intolerable, as well as the potential that it might lead to displacement. And there was, I think, a consensus that this should be avoided at all costs.
And what about any infrastructure for Palestinian refugees who may be fleeing Rafah?
Again, our position has been that there should be no displacement, that there shouldn't be no measures undertaken by Israel that would force a displacement, and thereby we don't anticipate nor condone, and there are no provisions for accommodation of displaced persons on our territory. I think, again, the chorus of consensus among the participants of the G20 is that military activity in Rafah should not occur. We have been very clear from the outset. We need a ceasefire now. We cannot tolerate further loss of life. Civilians who have reached 29,000 and counting, 20,000 of which are women and children, 17,000 children orphaned, 70, 80,000 injured.
And just finally, is there anything you think that Israel's allies could do to prevent that invasion we've talked about in Rafah from taking place in the next few days?
A call for the cessation of hostilities, a resolution of the Security Council would have sent a strong message. We call on all of our partners to do everything possible to contain the situation and not lead to further deterioration of the humanitarian situation or widening of the conflict.
Egypt's Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry speaking to Ione Wales. The actor Alec Baldwin isn't on trial, but at a court hearing that's got underway in Santa Fe, New Mexico, he was the one blamed for accidentally killing the director of photography on a film set. It was in October 2021 that Baldwin picked up a gun which he thought was armed with blank bullets. What happened next is still a matter of dispute, but the gun fired and shot dead Halina Hutchins. Alec Baldwin will go on trial for involuntary manslaughter at some point in the future, date undecided. Right now, though, it's the film's armourer, Hannah Gutierrez, who's facing that same charge. In his opening remarks, the lead prosecutor outlined their argument for saying she was at fault.
Once the live ammunition was on the set, she failed to detect it because she didn't follow those essential safety protocols that required her to inspect every round before they were placed into the gun. The evidence will show that the defendant treated the safety protocols as if they were optional, rather than if people's lives counted on her doing her job correctly.
Our correspondent Emma Vardy was in court in Santa Fe. She explained how the defense lawyers are trying to blame Alec Baldwin for the accident.
That is a major part of their argument. What they're saying is one of the most basic rules of gun safety is that you don't point a gun at somebody unless you're intending to kill them. And they argue that what Alec Baldwin did that day in a rehearsal was to be holding the pistol, albeit that he had been told it was only loaded with blanks or dummies, and that he pointed it at Halina Hutchins, who was a camera operator, a cinematographer there, as part of this rehearsal. But then when the gun went off, whether he pulled the trigger or not, he argues he didn't. The prosecution say he did. But the defense say, look, that was the basic rule of gun safety. You should never point that gun in that way. And that is what Alec Baldwin did. The other part of their argument is that they say corners were cut all over the production. They say Hannah Gutierrez Reed is the armorer. She was made to do two jobs as a props assistant, as well as looking after the weapons, that this was too much. And therefore, she didn't have time to check weapons properly before they were given to actors. The prosecution paint a very different picture. They say she was careless, that there were live rounds which belonged to her personally, which got mixed up with the blanks that were supposed to be used on set. And if she'd done the right checks, this would have been found out. The defense, though, say she's being made a scapegoat.
What they've tried to do, and what you're seeing in this courtroom today, is trying to blame it all on Hannah, the 24-year-old, because why? Because she's an easy target. She's the least powerful person on that set. So what do? And you're going to see the evidence. They target her.
Okay, well, that was the defense blaming Alec Baldwin and dismissing the charges. What else happened in court today?
Well, the most tragic part of the day really was that we watched this extended piece of body-worn video from one of the first police officers on the scene. And it shows Halina Hutchins her final moments, really, the last moments that she was alive, and that she was lying on the floor of this chapel where they'd been rehearsing the scene. She's surrounded by medics, clearly trying desperately to save her life. And at that point, she's clearly still alive. You can see her head moving from side to side. You can hear cries of pain from what we believe to be the director, Joel Souza, who was also hit by the bullet, lying on the floor, being attended next to her. A really difficult watch. And then the video also goes on to show the armourer, her first reaction. So Hannah Gutierrez Reed, extremely distressed when she finds out that a bullet has hit Halina Hutchins, has hit Joel Souza. She doesn't know the full implications at that moment, but we saw very clearly the jury being shown on video the aftermath of this tragic scene. Now, the questions, though, still remain. How did live ammunition get onto a film set? It was never supposed to be there. And that is one of the key things that the jury is being asked to consider. This carelessness on behalf of the armourer, or was it film corners being cut in more general sense on the film set?
Emma Vardy. Relations between China and the West have not exactly been cordial in recent times. Insults have been thrown back and forth. China's ambassadors have been nicknamed wolf warriors for their propensity to take a supposedly aggressive stance towards the countries where they're based. But now there are signs of a new stance in the form of pandas. China is making arrangements with zoos in the US, Spain and Austria, which could pave the way to lending them a few of the distinct black and white bears. And as our Asia-Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton explained to me, panda diplomacy rather than wolf diplomacy could be the sign of a more general thaw.
Relations are on a bit of a better track between the United States and China, between China and the EU, than they were previously. So they have improved in terms of things like trade. We know that China is trying to boost exports. There is a link between trade deals and panda deals. The world's biggest trading partners have received the most pandas, according to academic studies. So it seems that when China wants to improve its economy, it tends to lend out more pandas.
There is quite a history here, isn't there, of so-called panda diplomacy?
That's right. China has a long history of giving pandas away, even as far back as the Ming Dynasty. However, the modern era of gifting pandas started in 1972. That's when China agreed to give, it was a gift, to pandas to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. The big moment really was that the United States had just established relations with China, had switched its allegiance from the government in Taiwan to the government in China, recognizing the communist leadership there. Now, when it comes to pandas, things really changed in 1984 because those gifts suddenly changed to leases. So countries around the world pay about $1 million per bear, and any cubs born outside of China are said to belong to China. But we think there are around 60 bears or so now still lent out to 19 countries around the world. Zoos really fight to be able to retain their pandas. They're very, very expensive to keep. You know, the average panda eats 18 kilos of bamboo per day, but zoo attendance is reported to double when they have pandas. And so it's very, very important to zoos to try to hold on to any pandas that they might be able to procure from Beijing.
Celia Hatton. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
See that dog up on the balcony there, that German Shepherd? That's my dog, Commander. I was worried if he came down here with all of you, he'd just do nothing but kiss you and lick you.
Why President Biden's pet dog was anything but a big softy during his stay at the White House. President Biden has criticized Alabama's Supreme Court, which ruled that frozen embryos and fertilized eggs could be legally classified as children. Mr. Biden said this disregarded women's ability to make decisions for themselves and for their families. Health workers in Alabama have also said they're shocked and confused by the decision, as it means people could now face prosecution if embryos are damaged or destroyed. The ruling was originally issued in wrongful death cases brought by three couples who had frozen embryos which were ruined in an accident at a fertility clinic. As our correspondent Nomia Iqbal reports from Alabama, the court ruling marks a new chapter in America's long-running and bitter battle over reproductive rights.
This ruling has sparked a series of warnings about how fertility treatment will be affected. Doctors at a major clinic have told us that many of them will be frightened to store frozen embryos in the future, a normal procedure in IVF. This decision has led to treatments being halted and created uncertainty for thousands of women who need help getting pregnant. 42-year-old Veronica Webby Upchurch has one child through IVF and has two frozen embryos, but is scared of trying again in case she faces prosecution.
I understand the idea of attaching emotion to the embryos. They signify potential, but you can't cuddle an embryo, you can't breastfeed an embryo, and I think there is an emotional side of this, and I don't think that the law should be based on the emotional side of it.
One group that describes itself as pro-life said the decision had caused confusion, but others have welcomed the ruling, saying a life is a life, whether it's in the womb or in a laboratory. Alabama, like many other southern states, outlaws all abortions, making no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. But it is the only state that has now defined life as beginning at conception. The ruling is based on an existing state law in Alabama to do with unlawful deaths of minors. That means it's part of the constitutional law here, so it's unlikely to be overturned by the federal Supreme Court. But reproductive rights groups say 12 states which have banned abortion from the moment of conception may now look to Alabama to set the same standard.
Noumya Iqbal. Subatomic physics is not normally thought of as a particularly romantic subject. So you know something's up when scientists get all affectionate about an atomic particle. And that, it seems, is what's happened to the team at CERN, the huge nuclear research centre on the French-Swiss border. They've managed to make a particle of something called positronium. It's such a big deal, their spokesman, Ruggero Caravita, says they're in a bit of a swoon.
We are particularly in love as physicists with positronium because we can calculate very accurately its energy levels and it's a perfect system to do experiments with.
The object of Mr. Caravita's love is very fleeting. Scientists managed to make the positronium last for just 142 billionths of a second. But with a bit of work, this could have all sorts of implications. For one, it could answer questions about the origins of the universe. And there are practical applications too. First, though, what exactly is positronium? I sought explanation from our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
Positronium is incredible stuff. It consists of an electron, the basic unit of electricity, and its antimatter opposite, which is a positively charged positron, hence the name positronium. Now, that's different from the atoms that we know today that build up the world around us. The simplest atom we know is hydrogen, which consists of a proton in the middle, if you think back to your school days, and an electron orbiting around the outside. That's purely matter, the stuff that everything, including you and I, are made of. What's remarkable about positronium is it's half matter and half antimatter. And I know what your next question is.
What antimatter is?
Yes, exactly. So at the beginning of the universe, there was the exact opposite of matter, antimatter, in equal amounts. And so you'd have thought that if they were the same amount, then they would have combined and cancelled each other out. But yet here we are having this conversation. So something must have happened to mean that matter won out in that initial battle between matter and antimatter. And the thinking is that there must be some subtle difference between the two. This is why positronium is so interesting. It's a simple system that contains both matter and antimatter right next to each other so they can look out for any differences. But there's a problem. Positronium moves around too much because of thermal effects. So what the big achievement at CERN has been is to find a way of slowing it down by using lasers.
I read that they've managed to create this piece of positronium for just 142 billionths of a second. Now, is that long enough to do anything useful?
It is. The positron and the electron come together and annihilate each other just in that time. But in the moment that it exists, you can get a lot of useful information out of it. So they've managed to slow it down by getting it down to minus 100 degrees Celsius. They can find out the difference between matter and antimatter. And it could be used, if it can be tamed in this way, for all sorts of applications to create a laser that could be used for medical imaging and even for a propulsion system for interstellar travel.
Palab Ghosh. Now from interstellar space to the depths of the ocean. One of the great mysteries of the sea has been the song of the humpback whale. How that sound is produced has never been fully understood. Until now, as our science correspondent Victoria Gill explains.
The haunting song of the humpback whale. When this reverberated through ships' hulls, sailors used to think it was ghosts or mythical sea creatures. Now, a study has revealed exactly how some of the ocean's largest whales sing underwater. The researchers studied three dead whales that had been found stranded. They removed and examined their voice boxes. This strange footage, captured by the scientists with a tiny medical camera, is filmed inside the vibrating vocal anatomy of a minke whale.
You actually pumped air through these vocal structures, didn't you? So what did that show you?
So we could show that, A, that actually the larynx makes sound still in whales, but that it does so in a very unique way. And so what they do, we think, is that they exhale air from their lungs past the larynx. There it gets basically collected in a big sac that sits sort of here. And then when they're done with the vocalization, they basically contract that sac. It goes back into the lungs and then they can make a new vocalization.
That air recycling is unique to these baleen whales. It means they can sing while holding their breath and without inhaling water. More analysis showed that the sound produced by ships' engines overlaps with the frequency of whales' vocalizations, so the noise we make can interrupt them. These animals have to find each other over hundreds of miles using sound. It's integral to their lives. So the scientists hope that this research will help us to keep the noise down.
Victoria Gill. Politics can sometimes be a dog-eat-dog world, but Secret Service agents at the White House may have bitten off more than they can chew when it comes to President Biden's German Shepherd. New documents have shed light on the extent to which the pet known as Commander made life for those agents rather tougher than they'd have liked. From Washington, here's Will Vernon.
It's difficult to think of any building in the world better protected than the White House. Guarded round the clock by the US Secret Service, highly trained agents ready to respond to any unforeseen dangers, including, it seems, the four-legged kind.
You see that dog up on the balcony there, that German Shepherd? That's my dog, Commander. I was worried if he came down here with all of you, he just do nothing but kiss you and lick you.
New documents released in response to a Freedom of Information request show that Commander attacked Secret Service agents on around 24 separate occasions over a nine-month period. Following one encounter with the presidential pooch, an agent required stitches and tours around the East Wing were suspended due to blood on the floor. The next month, Commander bit another agent so hard it caused a deep, open wound, resulting in the loss of a significant amount of blood from one arm. A White House spokesperson said the Bidens tried everything to keep the German Shepherd's teeth as far away as possible from the arms and legs of the Secret Service, even sending him to see animal behaviourists. The canine counselling, though, was unsuccessful, and in October last year, Commander was sent away to live with relatives.
Will Vernon. Now, many of us would find the idea of hiking up and down Africa's highest mountain daunting, if not impossible. So spare a thought for 32-year-old Ben Stewart, who's become the first person to climb Mount Kilimanjaro backwards. The personal trainer from England has already conquered Britain's highest peaks backwards, but this is by far his most impressive achievement. He did it to raise funds for the charity the British Heart Foundation after his grandfather died prematurely of a heart attack. Beverly Ocheng asked him why he decided to do something so unconventional.
That's a great way to put it. I'm a personal trainer, so for me, seeing people every single day wanting to get fitter, wanting to improve themselves, and of course there's some amazing challenges out there, whether it's a marathon or a fun run or whatever you do to raise money, but I really wanted to stand out and I wanted to try and do something a little bit unique. The backwards thing fell into my lap one afternoon a few years ago, and now Kilimanjaro has been my fourth challenge and fourth successful challenge now. I'm back home and obviously got up and down in one piece.
It has varying degrees of difficulty. So how did you predict what comes next and how long did it take you compared with if you just climbed it as one would?
There are seven routes up and down Kilimanjaro. We did take the longest route, which allows for some better acclimatization. It allows for some longer rest times in the camp. But really, I still completed it with the rest of the team. There was eight of us in our group. We all finished across the line all together. And it was amazing, but there was a lot of intangibles that I really wasn't expecting.
So I personally started off hiking with the plans to climb a mountain eventually. And I'd like to know, how did you prepare for this 5,000 metre climb backwards?
It's nearly 6,000 metres above sea level. There's lots of aerobic fitness. So the personal trainer inside me, the training went really well. Here we don't have an awful lot of altitude. So the one unknown for me was the altitude. But the Tanzanian guides, they're great. They do this week in, week out. So I was really just humbled by listening to their advice and just really taking on board the fact that if I'm fit enough and I've trained for nearly 10 months to be able to walk backwards for long, long periods of time, there is no race up this mountain. One bit of advice I had on Kilimanjaro was there is no benefit in getting to the camp early. So if you need a break on the side of the mountain, take the break, have some water, have some snacks. So with that in mind, I would say everyone, you know, take in their own pace, make sure you're enjoying it. I had a great time out there in the most part, but it was incredibly challenging. Easily to say the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And hopefully the fundraising is going to reflect that.
Ben Stewart speaking to Beverly Ocheng. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast soon. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney, the producer was Emma Joseph, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.